Could you discuss how one locked into such a pattern can link back up with their own inner guide?
To the extent that you are a form, you are in codependency. I mean, it's built into the system. You can see it as an error, but it's the way of things, that everything is dependent on everything else. And you've got to be very careful about the illusion of free will. I hate to join the issue, but I must. Because who it is that thinks they can escape from anything has been had. I mean, whoever is free, since all form is within law, your thoughts are form, and they're within law too. So the thought, I think I'll go hear Ram Dass, which you thought was free will, it didn't come out of nothing. It came out of all this other stuff. And if you were hip enough, you'd be able to predict, now she's going to say, I think I'll go hear Ram Dass. So you weren't free. So once you know that, you relax. Because you're so busy thinking you're supposed to do something about something. And the only part of you that's free is the part that has no form, that's no part. So that's interesting. You are free, but who you think you are isn't. So you see that predicament. So who you think you are is codependent. Who you think you are can't escape from that. Because the attempt to escape is reinforcing the who you think you are, which is always codependent. See our predicament. I mean, I'm just sort of spelling out the problem as we start to sort of play with it a little bit. Now, I think the art is to learn how to, as Don Juan said, huff and puff and make believe it makes a difference, even though you know that it doesn't. See? Yeah? I'll tell you, I've got to do this thing, even though I've done it many times. It's such a good routine, I just can't resist. Some of you know it well, so... In all the years that I have studied psychology and been a professor of therapist, been in analysis for many years, took drugs, ad nauseum, ad ecstasy, went to India, had guru, had practices, meditated for 20 years now, done many practices in all that time, I have not gotten rid of one neurosis. Not one. You would think, sort of, that just by... that by attrition, some of them would have gone, you know? But I could still find all of them, just these subtle little things. But now, as I've said before, instead of these huge monsters that take me over, like, you know, like lust, you're going along, and then suddenly lust comes, and then you're... Won't you come up and see my holy pictures, you know, and you just turn into this thing. Instead of these monsters that take you over, what they are now are these little schmooze. Ah, sexual perversity. I haven't seen you in weeks. Come on in and have tea, you know. And what happens is that your personality, which we revere so much in this culture, is so real. It becomes your style. Your neuroses are your style. And they're sort of sweet, you know? I mean, we all have neuroses. It's not mine. I mean, mine are real. I love those kind of dialogues. Like, I'm depressed. You're really depressed? Yeah. Are you fully depressed? Yes, I am fully depressed. No part of you that's not depressed. No, I'm really depressed. Tell me, is the part that's talking to me noticing the depression, is that depressed? Well, no, that's just noticing the depression. Aha. See? And then you sneak up on it. You keep cultivating the witness that is witness to your personality machinations and delights. So in a way, what I'm suggesting is that the things stay, but you change your relationship to them because you keep cultivating a deeper context in which they exist. And as the context gets broader, they become less things which are doing you in all the time. But they're still around.
Earlier, you referred to life as a schoolroom and experiences as curriculum. And then you referred to incarnation as a game. What are your thoughts about the purpose of all of this?
The predicament with that question is that it's a question of the mind. And the answer is an answer you can be, but you can't know. So no answer that I can give your mind will satisfy it, because it can't know the answer, because it can only be the answer. And for that, dualism has to dissolve into itself. Because there are many levels of answer to that question. For example, since time is only real on certain planes, there are other planes where it isn't. It's all present simultaneously. So when you say, how did it all begin, or why did it begin, or who thought it up, that is a time concept that's only relevant within the realms your mind plays in. And actually, nobody thought it up and nothing happened. Also, so it's going to make the answering difficult, as you can see. See, because I don't know what you're talking about. See? Okay. You know, or I'll tell him when I see him. I mean, you can feel how it all gets kind of... I mean, I can give you lots of games to answer that, like it's the one is sitting there and it... or stand or whatever ones do, and it manifests in order to become the many, in order to know itself, because that's all part of the one, the creative act of the formless into form, and it's constantly creating and destroying and creating and destroying, and that's over kalpas and yugas in Hinduism and all that stuff, and it's kind of a wheel of something, the one having the illusion of being in form, going into the dream and then awakening out of the dream. And the entire curriculum is just that whole process of going into the dream and coming out of the dream, which is all just part of the perfection of the one being the many and being the one. The many is included within the one. So within the one, nothing's happening. It's just like dream stuff happening. And it's not purposive other than the creative act of it knowing itself. But that's all... I mean, the Buddha said it's none of your business. That was his answer. Which is the one I said about the mind. So I can't really do better than that on that question. Questions? Yes.
I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about oughts and shoulds on the spiritual path. Particularly, I should meditate.
The cute line that comes to mind is, I'm tired of being should upon. We have a tendency in our culture to run ahead of ourselves with our minds. The mind anticipates where you want to get to. I want to be just like, you know, the Virgin Mary. And then we try to imitate it. And that's the mind. And there's a timing, like often... my mind will see where I'm going to go before I'm ready really to go there. I'm inclined, like, I went through periods where I ought to meditate, and now I'm at the period where, you know, there's no ought about it. I mean, I just want to meditate, or I just meditate, even beyond want to meditate. And I realized that a lot of the times when I was busy, like, I remember being with Trungpa Rinpoche, a rascal some of you must have known, it's from your territory. And one day I was with Trungpa, and he was, I went to him to give him, consult about my meditation. And he said, Ram Dass, you shouldn't be doing what this thing you're doing. Well, all you should do is this one where you expand outward, Ati Yoga. He said, let's do it together. And we were sitting opposite a table, and he had a sake bottle and his glasses. And we looked in each other's eyes, and we started to go out, just into deeper presence. And I, at one point, he said to me, Ram Dass, are you trying? I said, yeah, I'm trying. He says, no, don't try. Just expand outward. It was like, oh. And then, ah. It's the funny place that the stance of trying ultimately is just another, it's the ego sneaking around saying, look how holy I am. And Trungpa's other line is, enlightenment is the ego's ultimate disappointment. See? And it's not going to give up easily. So it's going to sneak around and say, I'll make you a real yogini, you know, just meditate with me. You know, you ought to meditate more. And you get one of the last traps on the spiritual path is righteousness. And people become such good yogis. And it's known as the golden chain in India. It's gold, but it's still a chain. And you finally have to eat your own righteousness. And you're finally doing what you're doing because you're doing what you're doing. Right? Yes?
You talk about pain and suffering as grace. But how, when you're in the middle of it, can you see it as grace?
Well, usually you don't. Because you're in it and it seems like real suffering. However, over time, there is something that changes in you. See, you're glumping along, full of consciousness, and then some drama sucks you in, and you take it as real, and you're suffering. And then later, much later, you are back in your consciousness, and you say, wow, did I get lost in that one? You know, it's like Uspensky in Search of the Miraculous describes how he was walking mindfully down the street. Uspensky is walking down the street. Uspensky is turning left. And then he was doing this mindfulness exercise, and then suddenly he saw the tobacco shop, and he remembered he needed pipe tobacco. Oh, I need pipe tobacco. And 2 days later, he remembered he was doing the experiment. Okay, I mean, he lost it completely. So what you can expect is that the first probably 50,000 times, the drama will creep up on you because the mind, what it does is a thought comes and it says, psst, I'm real. Think me. See? You know? And you buy in. And you, because it says it in such wily, cute ways, you know, that, you know, this pain in my knee is real. I remember we used to do vow sittings in meditation. And the teacher would say, you must vow that for the next 50 minutes you will not move at all. You won't die, but just don't move. So I vow not to move. And you start, the bell rings, and suddenly you have this excruciating pain in your knee. Well, the one I remember vividly was sitting there in this hot room with 100 people in Bodh Gaya in India. And then a mosquito, hearing a mosquito going through the room. See, the first compassionate thought is, I hope it lands on someone else. And then it comes, and it's, and then slowly it lands on the cheek, and you feel it looking for the place to go in, and then it goes in, and you feel its body getting heavier with your blood, and then since you can't do anything, you feel it take its fill, and then it staggers with its load for takeoff, flies away, and then you feel the chemical it left start to swell and itch, and then the itch exists, and then it changes, and then it goes away. So, and what you learn from that is suffering comes and suffering goes. I mean, at first, the suffering takes you over, the mind stuff takes you over so fast that, and then the adrenaline pumps and there's all kinds of secondary stuff in it, and then you only wake up later on. As your practices deepen, you wake up sooner and sooner and sooner. You still fall asleep as often. Until finally, the thing is shortcut so much, short-circuited, that as you're falling asleep, you're waking up. Because the very falling asleep, the very dying into the thickness of the drama, wakens you. It's like you've moved it to an energy level where you're just feeling like you just dove into water from air. You feel thick. And you know you're trapped. You don't even know what you're trapped about. You just know you're trapped and you start the change. So the in answer to the question, at different stages, different ways work in dealing with that kind of stuff of suffering. Yes.
How do you deal with someone like Hitler? And do you ever get angry at people now that you know all of these things?
I think that one learns how to discriminate between a being's acts and the being. And I can abhor Hitler's acts and see them as the product of a culture and the product of all kinds of patterns in his karma, and do my best to stop his acts or not allow it to happen or something. At the same moment, not close my heart to that being who is going through that process. There was an interesting moment I had. I was at a Benedictine monastery, and where I was going through the offices of the day with the monks, and after several days, one night, the abbot invited me into his study, and he was a beautiful German scholar, rosy-cheeked, pudgy, beautiful little man, wonderful. And he looked up at me, and he said, "Ram Dass, there's just one question I have to ask you. What was the meaning of the kiss between Judas and Jesus?" And I said, "Perhaps they were enjoying the game." And he went into ecstasy, and we started dancing around the room together. See, because in the world he lived in, he couldn't find anybody that would experience the one behind the two of good and evil, of dark and light. The G. Manly Hall thing, "One who knows not that the prince of darkness is but the other face of the king of light knows not me." And the appreciation of how you act impeccably both in the world of one and two. So in the world of two, you stop Hitler. In the world of one, you are Hitler. Do you hear what I'm trying to deal with here in the question, in the way I'm dealing with it? Now, that when you go back through form and go to the edge of formlessness or God or the nameless or whatever you want to call the thing that has no name, you come to the place where everything breaks down into two. The first polarization, the one becomes two. Dark and light, yab, yum, positive and negative energy, like there's no forms until there's positive and negative energy. Do you see that, what I mean? Good and evil, all of this stuff. That's a plane of reality where it's already started to come into two. Behind that, there's only one. You and I are real on both of those planes. So is Hitler. Hitler is both in the world of evil, and he's also part of God. And that's our responsibility, to live simultaneously on both of those planes. And on the plane of two, you stop Hitler. On the plane of one, you realize Hitler is part of us. The question, do I get angry? Yes, sure. But I let it go just about as fast as I possibly can. Because I've got this rascal always, sort of laughing at me. Saying, "Oh, got you again," you know. So I don't take my anger very... We have on the table of the Seva Foundation these Groucho Marx glasses. This is from Wavy also. And if anybody uses the word, the S word, you know what that is, this serious. You got to put on the glasses and you go right on with your conversation, you know. So we don't take ourselves too seriously. And so same with anger. I mean, Maharaji said to me, "Give up a little anger each day and I'll help you." And he has. And I realize that finally the part of me that gets angry is the part that has a model of how reality ought to be other than the way it is. I mean, if you're a sleazy rat, that's your karmic problem. If I get freaked by it, that's my problem. And I get freaked by it because I have a model, you shouldn't be a sleazy rat. How do I know why you're a sleazy rat? Maybe that's you're on the sleazy rat path. You know, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah.